Why don't you leave as rudely as you entered? Don't bother saying goodbye.
Hello, everybody. This is Again With This, Melrose Place. Today's episode is Season 3, Episode 19, Boxing Sydney. Yuck. And now here are your hosts, Tara Ariano and Sarah D. Bate.
Hi, Sarah.
Hello, Tara and Dave.
Do you want to talk a little bit about this title before we get into our Again With This tease?
Sure. Yes. I mean,
give us the information to get a leg up on the competition.
This title, Boxing Sydney, refers to an independent film of the era, Boxing Helena, which involved like a quadruple amputee in a box. This is not appropriate. It's not as bad as I Am Curious Melrose, but it's bad.
Living in a box.
Should say
living in a cardboard box,
not just a quadruple amputee. It's like someone who becomes a quadruple amputee because like a weirdo captures her and like wants to constrain her motions by amputating her limbs and putting her in a box.
Yeah.
Have you ever seen that? Before we started, Sarah
Happy
and I were
birthday
like,
to me.
Yeah, we both couldn't remember if we'd ever seen it. And then Dave, have you seen it?
No, I just remember the video box art cover in the store and going, nope.
Exactly. Ooh. All right, well, let's move on from that cheery topic too. Again with this, episode 40, dropping March 26th.
You Boxing Helena! Just kidding.
You asked for it. It's finally here. Let's watch the Melrose Place polygraph episode of Seinfeld. It's season 6, episode 16, The Beard. At least that's what Google says. Hulu, where you can watch it, calls it episode 15. I think because the episode before was the 100th episode and they did like a clip show that was an hour. I don't know why. But anyway, season 6, episode either 15 or 16. The episode title is The Beard. We'll put the Hulu link in the show notes. Also, as a programming note, for our March 29th episode, we're going to be unlocking the Patreon episodes on the Models, Inc. pilot and the Gross Point pilot, because while we record these in advance, the day you are hearing this happens to be my brilliant co-host's birthday. Happy birthday, Sarah.
Thank you.
And I was not the only one who wanted to make it very special for her this year. Let's hear clip 2, please, Dave.
Sarah, surprise, it's Jack Wagner. How are you? This is a gift to you from your very, very dear friend, Tara.
Tara.
And I understand that you Domer. Are a GH fan and that you guys are big Melrose Place fans. I understand you have a birthday coming up, so I'm so happy to be a part of this. And I just want to sing to you, happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear Sarah. Happy birthday to you and many more. I hope that you have an amazing birthday. And I understand that you have like a Melrose podcast, which is so cool. I mean, what a great show that was. And I hope you have an amazing 2021. And just remember something, that you're all I need. All right, Sarah, have a beautiful birthday and sending my love to you.
First of all, props to Tara. Happy birthday, Sarah. And let's give it up for Jack Wagner for peeing during that whole birthday message. Well done, sir.
Very impressive. Very impressive.
Yeah, what a delight. What a joy. Jack Wagner standing by his pool, which apparently has a water feature that was not visible in the video, but yes.
Yeah, him peeing. He is the little Cupid statue. Apparently he turned around this request real fast. So
he did. He did
it. He's a pro.
In less than 12 hours. So if you are, if you have any Jack Wagner fans that you need a cameo from, highly recommend. Rated him 5 stars. Anyway. happy birthday, Sarah, from me and
thank
my
you
dear
so
friend
much.
Jack.
This really lit up my entire week receiving this, so thank you.
You're so welcome. So we will be releasing a brand new Patreon episode that Friday, April 2nd, as usual, and our topic that day will be, let's watch Luke Perry's debut on What I Like About You. That one is season 3, episode 17, Dangerous Liaisons. That's on HBO Max, and we will link you that in the show notes as well.
And because March is, a lot of people don't know this, 400 days long, our March episode of Again With Them, our monthly digest of Jenny and Tori's podcast, 90210 OMG, will drop April 1st. That is a perk for our Patreon supporters at the $5 level and up. No fooling.
Nah.
Sorry. I mean, I'm not sorry. And we're not fooling.
Yes. So you can get all of that at patreon.com/againwiththis. And thank you so much to all of our Patreons who are already supporting us there. All right. Let us get into this episode, the very inappropriately titled Boxing Sydney. Starting with our C-plot, Matt spends more time with his gay cop friend. Not so much his friend, but, you know.
Yeah.
So Matt confronts Kimberly at her locker. She taunts him about his broken ribs, and he notes that she was pretty busy while he was laid up. Clip 3.
So that's why you had those guys beat me up, so that you could tamper with the results of your psychological evaluation.
Do you lie awake at night dreaming up these accusations?
No. Intelligent, impetuous, caring. Princess Di, maybe. You, never.
It's right there in black and white.
Forgery. But the testing service doesn't keep copies. But you knew that, didn't you?
I would imagine changing those results would be as easy as, say, changing the blood alcohol level in a car accident report.
I did that to save your precious little Michael. You know, if it wasn't for me, he'd be up in Lompoc and you'd be baking hacksaws into devil's food cake.
Wow, must be nice to have a job that leaves you so much free time. I have rounds.
Someday, somehow, I will get you out of this hospital and you will never practice medicine again anywhere.
Matt, you're pathetic.
And you're... wig is crooked.
It's very good.
Extremely good. He agrees. It's in the visual aids.
Yeah. He's very proud of that one.
Yeah. Especially since, like, you wouldn't necessarily think that kind of, like, low-hanging burn would work on her, but it totally does. She, like, runs to the mirror to check.
Yeah. Also, I was thinking about this, like, by this time, it seems like her hair should have grown back. Like, she's been back for a good long time.
Yeah.
But I guess not. Like, at least, you know, maybe not on the scar, obviously, but, like, enough to, you know, fall over it.
Come down and cover it. Yeah.
Yeah. What do I know? Again, it's a soap. We're getting into another cul-de-sac about realism.
Yeah, it's
why?
True.
So then Matt has lunch with the detective whose name is John Rawlings and tells him about Kimberly hiring the dudes who beat him up and why. Rawlings wants to find the assailants and get them to implicate Kimberly, but Matt just says thanks anyway and is about to leave when Rawlings tells him to stay and finish his lunch. Matt knows Rawlings just wants to help him.
Mm-hmm. No, I don't know if that's what he wants to do.
Thank you. But Matt needs to handle it himself. And Rawlings backs off and then inappropriately adds that while he feels bad about what happened to Matt, Matt has to look on the bright side. Rawlings met him. And Matt looks creeped out by this, as he should. You can see that in the visual aids as well. So then Rawlings asks what Matt does for fun. Like, what section of the paper does he read first? Which, by the way, I thought, that's a pretty good first date line. It's like a good icebreaker.
It is.
But Matt doesn't want to give Rawlings the wrong impression and says he just ended a long relationship. But he urges Rawlings not to take it personally and heads back to work. And Rawlings looks mildly perturbed by this.
He also looks fucking creepy.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah.
Some number of nights later, Kimberly's driving when she gets pulled over and is told to get out of the car. Surprising no one, the cop pulling her over is Rawlings, and he is very aggressive, telling her to put her hands on her head and so on, ordering her over the curb to cuff her while she wriggles and protests. But he tells her he's arresting her for the attack on Matt, pulling out his gun as he says he doesn't tolerate gay bashers. He knows where she works. He knows where she lives, so she better clean up her act or he'll make her life miserable. And he puts the gun away and uncuffs her, spitting at her to get out of there. And she peels out as he watches her go, looking super smug. And the next day, Matt's ordering a coffee when Rawlings appears with good news. He took care of Matt's little problem at work. Kimberly will not be bothering him anymore. Matt does not seem happy and says he just wanted this incident to die down because Kimberly's capable of anything. But Rawlings says he set her straight and Matt just needs to tell him if she bothers him again. Clip 4.
This is police harassment we're talking about.
I prefer to think of it as a perk. Hey, look, don't look so worried. I'm not the kind of super macho cop that goes around beating up on people.
It just concerns me that you did this because of me.
I was trying to help. I'll back off. You just say the word.
I want you to back off. Now I have to go back to work. Thanks for the coffee.
And this is why you don't date cops. Hey.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a bunch of reasons, but I would start here. Like, once they decide that they like you, do you have a choice? Who could say?
Right. Also, like, they weren't dating either. Like, Matt didn't even get to that stage. Like, it was not his choice at any point. This guy's just a super creep.
Yeah. And does it seem like Matt would be like, oh, well, I guess he really does like me. I've changed my mind. Like,
right.
is that a vibe you were getting there? Rawlsy?
Yeah. So anyway. Back at the hospital, Matt's in the elevator when Kimberly steps in. Clip 5.
I heard you had some trouble with the law.
Your beefcake boyfriend isn't satisfied writing parking tickets.
Kimberly, you should know that I had nothing to do with it.
It's all right. I'll get you for this fielding.
You know, you can't afford to get too nasty, Kimmy. The police are on your tail.
Truce, all right?
I'll think about it.
Hey, listen, the next time you go for a man in uniform, why don't you pick up a mailman?
This good probably belief. Won't happen again, but I agree with Kimberly. Go for a mailman. Yeah. Or a letter carrier, as we now say.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's where we leave them. This does not seem like it's going anywhere good, so good luck to Matt. Onto the B-plot. Sydney is literally the last to find out her new friends are in a cult. Outside the gates of the complex, Ricky and Sydney wait with luggage, the latter bitching that whoever's supposed to pick them up is an hour late. Clip 6.
Sydney, if you knew that you were going on the most incredible journey, surrounded by people that love you, and that during this journey you'd attain spiritual enlightenment, wouldn't you be happy to wait forever?
No, you would want it to start immediately. That makes no sense.
Or you would want it to never start because it sounds like you're going to be killed.
Okay. Either way, like.
Yeah.
Wait.
Shut up, Ricky. I think we agree, but from different directions.
Indeed. So then Jane comes out. Sydney laughs about Jane not having to make any wild accusations against her, at least for a few days, because Sydney's going on vacation. Jane snits that Sydney isn't going anywhere. She's unemployed and she has to meet with her probation officer. Ricky snorts at Jane, trying so hard to control Sydney's life when Jane's is in total disarray, which, fair cop.
True.
Jane ignores her, telling Sydney that she's in big trouble for her alleged crimes and Jane won't lie for her. But Sydney isn't asking her to, and right on cue, the cult bus rolls up. Perhaps Martin's name painted on it inspires Sydney to leave Jane with some of his wisdom. Clip 7.
You have no friends left. Your probation officer is the only person who can help you.
Drop the weight, Jane. Worry about your own responsibilities. That's what I'm learning to do.
It's not so much the words, it's the tone. Like, that's what I'm learning to do. Shut up. So, the bus arrives at the Abbott camp, which is rough. Sydney was expecting a resort, but Ricky corrects her. It's a retreat. And Martin comes out to greet everyone and starts handing out assignments. After he's moved on, Sydney starts bitching about the lack of bathrooms or a hot tub. But Ricky says it's much nicer than the last retreat, which was silent. Worrisome. And that night, everyone's gathered around a campfire as Martin tells a story about getting in a very minor car accident with his older brother when they were both little kids, and how his neighbor cared for him while Robert lied about the accident to get Martin in trouble. And that made Martin realize his family had never loved him and that he'd have to ditch them as soon as he could, which, you know, he was 7 at the time when this all happened. But sure, as an origin story, I guess.
My notes read, okay, Squeef Rainier. Actually, I think it's Rainieri, but you know what I mean.
Either way.
I mean, oh, God. Like, I would really like to get Robert on camera, mm-hmm. see what his take is on this story, because I have a feeling their whole family's like, well, look at him. Were we right or were we right? Like, yeah, sometimes you could just tell.
Yeah. So Sydney, who is new, is like, you still see them, right? And he's like, never. He has a new home now. He has a new family. All of them. And tomorrow, they'll take the first step to release the chains of their past. And as the meeting breaks up, Sydney says it was like he was talking about her life. And Ricky says they've all had similar experiences because that's how cults work.
Uh-huh.
And Martin wants Sydney to take care of the tea service, which means she'll have to stay up all night. Which I thought was just to dull her senses and judgment, but it's not. Sydney, joking but not really, enumerates the chores that she's already done today and asks how much more she's expected to do. And Ricky snits that Sydney's lucky to be there since she didn't pay. So Sydney asks what this tea service even is. And apparently Martin hardly sleeps, so Sydney just has to hang around near him and feed him during the night, which A, this is a grown man, B, use the money from Joe's cameras and buy this guy a GD hot plate, but Sydney decides she could probably do it. So later, Sydney brings a tray into Martin's trailer and finds him in bed with Ricky and some other broad or child, hard to say, she looks pretty young.
Yeah.
Sydney is shocked.
Whatever she is, she can't act.
Oh, no.
At all.
No. Sydney's shocked, but she holds it together. And then Martin tries to involve her. And this is a long clip, but, you know, it lays out the whole situation. Clip 8.
What do you think of my place?
Quite a setup.
I'm bad, I know. I should have told you Martin's my husband.
But you don't live together? You don't wear a wedding ring?
We don't need conventional tokens of marriage. Those are restrictions from the outside world. We have our own sign.
It's sensual.
It's a tattoo on
private
someone's neck.
Martin likes it like that.
This is new to you. But when you rid yourself of the impurities of the outside world, you'll find yourself full of love, and love is limitless. Why do people marry only one spouse? Who made that rule?
God.
Not us.
It's in the Ten Commandments.
And should we blindly carry out ancient traditions that have nothing to do with the real world?
You loved and married Michael, but that didn't prevent you from having feelings for Jake, did it? No.
It's all right, Sydney. Where there's love, there's trust. And there doesn't have to be any secrets when you love each other.
There's an extra cup, Sydney. Come on. Help yourself.
Only you have to drink it in bed with us.
Tea gives me a headache.
Leave the tray. I won't need you anymore tonight, Sydney. Sydney. Go in love.
Yeah, go in love, out to the road, and start walking right fucking now.
But no. Yeah, it's so corny. Like,
oh, God, it's so corny.
Yeah. Although at least they, I guess because 90210 was still sort of for teens, like he at least they make it explicit that, oh, yeah, this is a sex cult. Like the
right.
the new evolution sort of soft pedaled it.
Right.
More so than this does.
Yeah. I also feel like the show may have forgotten that Sydney was a sex worker. Like, granted, she was maybe not cut out for it, but mm-hmm. I think for her to be shocked by some of this is maybe not in character, but.
Yeah. Well, I mean, context matters as well. Like, if she thought this was a spiritual teaching and then all of a sudden it's like, oh, yeah, and we're going to fuck, too. It's like, oh.
Yeah. And it, I mean, it is also quite weird that her now roommate is apparently married to this guy and got his initial tattooed on her. And now mm-hmm. she's just learning this. So, yeah, fair.
Yeah. So the next day, Sydney's lost in thought while Martin exhorts everyone to write to their shitty family members and ask them to prove their love by giving them money for their spiritual education. And Ricky notices that Sydney isn't writing. Sydney says she has to get back to the city and deal with her life. Ricky guesses this is about what she saw last night. She didn't think that Sydney was such a prude. But Sydney says Ricky can do whatever she wants. So Ricky guesses Sydney is jealous of her. Clip 9.
Martin's smart. He's great looking. Every woman here wants to be with him.
Is he great looking? He looks like a founding father on a bill to me.
I had poor man's Paul Provenza, and then I was like, but is Paul Provenza the poor man's Paul Provenza?
Yeah.
Go ahead, fill up on bread. Like,
there's a real, it's a real wide range of what passed for like a hot male guest star love interest in the 90s. I'll just say that.
And it's like, well, if you can't afford an Arkin, I guess you get that guy.
Yeah. Like, he's not ugly, but he's not the kind of guy where you'd see and be like, oh, he's so hot. Like, he looks fine. He's not, you know, he's an actor. So he's, you know, there's a baseline level of attractive, but it's like.
Yeah, he just is not terribly, like, charismatic.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, like, you look at actual Keith Raniere and you're like, at first it's like.
Her?
That little troll? But, but then you start to see it. Like, it doesn't mm-hmm. work on you, but you get it.
Right.
Even as you're rolling your eyes. But this guy is sort of like, they just want. I also don't understand why TV cult leaders are always so tall. Like, I think they're usually kind of little and more relatable.
Sure. Charles Manson.
Like, Miscavige would fit in your pocket, but.
Yeah.
Not that I'm alleging anything.
Certainly
don't
not.
At me.
And Ricky's like, why doesn't Sydney just ask to fuck Martin? But Sydney, flustered, says that Ricky is trying to make her say things that aren't true, and Martin's trying to make her write this letter she doesn't feel comfortable with, so Sydney's going to go pack. And while she's going, Ricky catches Martin's eye, and he nods, and that doesn't seem great. Mm-mm. So that night, Sydney walks into Martin's trailer while he's on a headset phone, cutting edge, barking orders to his stockbroker. And she hangs back silently until he beckons her to come talk to him. So she sits on his bed and tells him that she wants to carry her own weight by going back to L.A. and handling all her various business. But Martin wants her to stay. Clip 10.
Are you saying I can't leave?
Everyone is free to come and go at the Abbott Way. There's no restrictions. There's no gate keeping anyone in.
Then I'm going.
We're miles from anywhere. The bus won't be headed back to Los Angeles until next week.
That's okay. I'm going to walk out to the highway and hitch a ride.
Go in love, Sydney.
I hope you really mean that.
Oh, Sydney, any adaptive fight or flight instinct?
Honestly,
at all.
I mean, she's almost there. She's trying to leave.
Yeah.
Why she waited this long to go is not clear to me, but sure. So it's light out when we see her again sitting at the side of the road as a truck comes towards her that she flags down. But it's Martin behind the wheel with Ricky looking furious in the passenger seat. And she tries to laugh off their concern and says she's fine. And then, of course, a bunch of Martin minions materialize in the truck bed to grab her and drag her in with them while Martin pulls a Yui. And then by night. Again, not sure about the passage of time, but a bunch of abbotitions drag Sydney through the camp toward a wooden hatch in the ground that Martin says is the cover for a very special place for her to meditate. And Sydney starts really fighting them then, but they are large and she is small. And before long, she's dropped in the hole and they lock the hatch and she pounds on the door and screams for help. But, you know, it's way past that point. And that's where we leave her in the ground.
Ooh. Poor Sydney.
Finally, our A plot. Amanda gets a diagnosis. Michael defies Amanda's orders from the previous episode and walks into her office at D&D. She tells him to leave, but he says they need to finish her workup. She can get a second opinion if she wants. She's not impressed by what she thinks are his attempts to scare her, but he thinks the biopsy already would have done that. And he pauses at the door and suggests that she use her bitchy attitude to fight her cancer, not him, when she surely has enough bitchy attitude to do both.
Seriously.
Joe has apparently acquired more cameras because she's using one to shoot Jake while he works on his bike beside the pool. And they discuss the scrapbook that she's putting together in case Austin ever wants to come and find her. And Jake is sure he will. Clip 11.
I don't know. Maybe he'll grow up angry his whole life that his mother gave him away, and maybe he'll never want to find me.
What is with the chirpy sing-song tone?
Yeah.
I don't know. I think we should have made that left on La Cienega.
Exactly. It's so weird. What are these choices?
Yeah, like, I mean, I also kind of don't understand, like, why, if Joe shut him down, like, just don't have her on the show for, like, a week. Stop putting them in scenes together and then stop bringing this up.
Right.
And then if she is having this affect about it, get another take.
Yeah.
You're a top 10 show.
Yeah.
Why do I care? It's a soap.
So
it's
Amanda
Billy,
gets,
except it isn't actually Billy right now, but it's Billy.
So Amanda gets home from work and immediately starts laying into Jake, saying she told him 100 times not to get oil on the pool deck. And though we're supposed to see this as evidence of her deteriorating mental health along with her physical health.
Yeah,
it's true.
No,
she has.
This is not unreasonable, and we have been bitching about it since before she even showed up. So, word, get your bike out of the fucking courtyard, you lummox.
Oh, God. So Joe tries to intervene on Jake's behalf, but Amanda snaps at her to drop the mother hen routine and stay out of other people's business, and then threatens to have the bike hauled off for scrap if she ever sees it by the pool again. Honestly, fucking do it. It's the only
Seriously.
Way he'll learn, apparently.
Yeah.
So then she goes up to her place and hears a message from another doctor, not Michael. She immediately calls him back and learns that he concurs with Michael. They will need further tests and she will need an oncologist. And at work the next day, Amanda's in the middle of reaming Allison out when she gets a call from a doctor, but manages to tell Allison she's off Jane's account before kicking her out to get on the phone. Michael wants to start tests immediately, which she says she can't, but he sternly tells her cancer doesn't stop for lunch, so she agrees, but makes sure to snit at him, not to keep her waiting. And she's on her way out when Billy stops her to say some client's going to be there at 2. She starts barking at him because she definitely will not be back by then, and Billy had no authority to schedule a meeting, and they have this exchange, clip 12.
Should I cancel? What am I going to tell Mr. Stewart?
Tell him you're an idiot.
He knows.
Oh, God. Also, why do you have account executives and copywriters doing your schedule? That's what an assistant is for. And once you've hired an assistant, get them to take the leather-bound Charles Dickens shit off your desk. Who is that for? It's in the visual aids. If someone can explain to me why the, like, modern library is, like, facing out on the desk, so it's not for her benefit, it's for clients, in case they want to leaf through some Horton. There's a lot.
Yeah. I mean, I think that was her point, because he was like, I checked with your assistant, you don't have anything this afternoon. And she was like,
well, oh, did he say that?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
But still, her point was like, you still can't make a meeting for me, which is true. Like,
right.
Don't make a meeting on my behalf.
I mean, I'm not trying to defend Billy. It's Billy. Tell him you're an idiot is a perfectly legitimate management strategy.
Yes.
And let's move on.
Indeed. At the hospital, Amanda looks tiny and scared in her hospital gown as she approaches the CAT scan and mumbles that it's freezing in there. And Michael promises that they'll be done in a few seconds and she'll be able to get dressed again, as though she's not more dressed in this gown than she ever is in what she wears to work, by the way.
Well, I was going to say, like, this is not somebody who pairs those micro minis with stockings.
No.
Not sure what difference that makes, but yeah.
Mm-hmm. So she balks at the form that she has to sign, complains about the cold again, and then announces that she's changed her mind about the test and tries to bolt. And Michael gets between her and the door, and she's very ready to knock him down, or so she thinks. But when she comes at him, he just grabs her around the shoulders and wrestles her onto the bed, which is finally when she just submits. Again, it's a sad scene because she's really scared, and we believe it. Like, she does a nice job.
Yeah, agreed.
And I also think that Calabro does a nice job of, like, meeting her energy, where it's like he knows, he understands where she is coming from. Like, this aggression is something else. And he's like, there's no point in trying to be nice or, like, wheedle her or just be like, no, listen, and blah, blah, blah. It's just like, no, I'm just going to grab her and put her on and just, like, force this to happen because that's the only way.
Right. And it's, I mean, it's well blocked so that you don't, like, given that Michael is a villain, usually.
Yeah.
It's well done by the production so that you don't feel like he's being creepy.
Yes. Yep.
Or like abusive. So yeah, it's good. It's, well, you know, weirdly unsoapy.
Yeah. I think they already weirdly laid track for this in a smart way in the episode where Peter was going to try to kill her in the operating room by having Michael be her protector.
Right.
Eventually.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. So when Amanda gets back, it's late enough for the janitor to be there cleaning up, but Billy is also there waiting up for her. She's in a more conciliatory mood and asks if he's still talking to her, and he just says, she's the boss. She thought they were more than that and offers to take him for dinner, but he declines. She says she could use a friend, so he relents. And they end up at the nice Italian place next to a mirror, which has to have been a logistical nightmare in terms of where to put the camera. But anyway, that's where she tells him about her diagnosis. He tells her she can beat it, but she says it'll take more than positive thinking. He says she doesn't have to go through it alone, and she makes sure he understands that no one else can know about this, not at work and not at the complex. Billy says she can trust him, so who will be the first person he tells? I think we all know.
Yeah. I mean, I really think Amanda doesn't care if anyone else knows. She just literally does not want Allison in particular to know.
Yep.
Here we all are together with Allison about to know.
Yep. So the next day, Michael shows Amanda her scans and says they should begin treatment immediately. Amanda wants to know about a cure because she apparently does not know what cancer is. Michael says there are good statistics for recovery, but when she asks, he admits they're actually only 50%. And then he gets beeped for another appointment and starts rushing away while she still has questions about hair loss, among other things. And she demands that he stay and deal with her as a patient, but she's not his only patient and he has to go. So she comes back to the office and Allison makes the mistake of asking where she's been. And Amanda snaps at her, and Allison's like, the art department needs an approval from you. And Amanda barks at her to keep her nose out of other people's business and work on her own shit, like the media buy for glorious gowns. And if Allison can't handle it, she can just quit. So Allison then quietly says, that media buy's been on Amanda's desk since 2:30. And instead of apologizing, of course, Amanda just says, Allison better have brought down the CPM, a queen. So when she's gone, Allison goes to Billy to rant about how fucked Amanda would be if Allison actually did quit. And Billy tells Allison to give her a break, but Allison can't put up with Amanda's Saddam Hussein style of business management, in case you forgot what year it is.
Yeah.
And then invokes the memory of Bruce as a superior boss, which, like, let's not get crazy, but Billy is clearly dying to tell Allison Amanda's big secret, but manages just to grunt that Allison has no idea what kind of rough time Amanda's going through. And Allison can obviously tell he's referring to something specific and demands that he tell her what it is. And he's already obviously said way too much, but still somehow thinks he's going to get out of it by saying he promised not to. Which, like, as soon as you say that, like, I have a secret and I can't tell you. It's like, you're going to say it, obviously. Like, this is how secret
works. Yeah. Or we're going to be here all day while I guess.
Exactly.
So save us both the trouble, loose lips, McGee.
So Allison, fishing for the hot goss, tries to claim she just wants to be understanding and needs all the facts. And
terrible.
Billy's an idiot, as Amanda said, and this works. So clip 13.
Amanda is seriously ill.
What's the matter with her?
Cancer.
What?
Cancer.
Who told you that?
Amanda.
Oh, please. She'd say anything to get things her way.
You better believe it, because it's true. All right? Now, in between her work appointments, she's running to the doctor.
Oh, my God.
So we need to pull together here for Amanda's sake.
I should apologize.
No. You can't let her know that I told you. You can't tell a soul. She doesn't want anybody to know.
Of course.
Cut to the crawl in Times Square. Amanda has cancer.
Yeah. Way to keep that secret for 16 whole hours, you fucking idiot. God.
God.
So.
And I love that she's like, Amanda's full of shit. And then he's like, well, but no, she's going to the doctor in between work appointments. And then Allison's like, oh, that's horrible. Like, wait, what in that convinced you?
Right. Yeah.
All right. Who cares? They're both terrible.
Yeah. I mean, I guess if it was coming straight from Amanda, that she would assume it wasn't, she wouldn't necessarily believe it, but coming through Billy, she doesn't think that Amanda would lie to him. Who knows?
Who knows?
Anyway, Amanda finds Michael at the hospital that night. She's been researching her condition and wants to talk specifics, like some particular drugs she thinks she should be on. Clip 14.
You came here to tell me the best protocol you should be on?
Yes.
No, wrong. For the record, this drug is FDA approved for breast and ovarian cancer and only under specific markers. You want to talk experimental protocols? I'd be happy to, Doc, okay?
Fine. I need names and adverse effects. And if you want to be my doctor, don't talk to me like I'm an idiot and do your homework.
Right, and don't tell me how to do my job.
Then don't tell me what kind of patient to be.
Oh.
Shouldn't Michael definitely not be her doctor? Because they know each other quite well. Like, obviously, it's not accurate to say that they're friends. But, like, they've had extensive business dealings. Like, it just seems really inappropriate.
Also, he's not an oncologist. End of story.
Right, that too.
But I can see them being like, well, he's a general, like, right, general practitioner. Who would refer her to a radiation oncologist? Like,
but he's not. He's a surgeon. Like, we've seen him in surgery.
Which is how he saved her, so.
Right. Anyway.
Yeah. I mean, her delivery of that line was really quite heartbreaking.
Like, it was.
Like I have said many times, like sometimes it's like, what are you doing here on this ridiculous soap doing this nicely nuanced work where we really feel sorry for you, even though this is a complete cartoon and Chris is marauding around somewhere playing dice games with the orderlies. Like, I mean, yeah. Poor Amanda.
So Kimberly rolls up just then and asks what that was about. Michael says that Amanda is his patient, but to Kimberly's obvious follow-up question, he can't say what he's treating her for, but if it works, he'll be making quite a name for himself. So no, Kimberly, it is not peroxide poisoning.
Oh, that's weak sauce from you.
Agree.
Dr. Shaw.
Yeah. But obviously her hair is on her mind, given the wig crack earlier. Anyway, moving on. Amanda is napping weirdly on her office couch. You can see this in the visual aids. She just looks like she, like, tipped over.
You know those Victorian photographs of the dead where they're posed as though they're lifelike? It was that, except the body sort of subsided to one side and also was wearing a 13-inch miniskirt. Yes. But other than that, totally the same.
Exactly. So that's what's happening when Michael shows up with a teddy bear and a strong suggestion that Amanda take some time off already. And he adds that her disease is not a death sentence, but it feels like that to her. Michael and this teddy bear are there to make sure she gets through it. And Amanda wearily says the bear is not her style. It's not his either. He knows they're both self-sufficient, but sometimes you need to seek comfort from others, which is what the bear is for, because she'll need something to hold on to when Michael's there to make her well. He's read over all the materials that she brought and is working with the best people in oncology, but she has to trust him. And if she's not good at that, she'll have to think of this as a learning experience. She tells him that they'll have to work around her work schedule for the sake of the company. So they set her next appointment, and then she does seem to soften as he leaves. And other than the teddy bear, which is like a very weird choice, and like when either of them is holding it, it's like so wrong, but that was a nice scene.
Yeah, I agree. I just sort of rationalized it to myself that there's probably like a nanny cam in the teddy bear because Michael is a creep, but I guess we'll find out.
Perhaps. All right, let's close this up by naming our episode MVP. Speaking of that last scene, Michael actually doing well by his patient.
I mean, it's tempting to put a button on this gag and say, Chris, still looting capture, and then just say it every week. But actually, it's Heather Locklear who is really doing great in this rather serious plot line. And I don't feel like she's doing Emmy grandstanding. I feel like it's very felt and it's good.
Yeah, I agree.
I'm impressed.
Least valuable player. Rawlings, the fucking creepy cop.
Yeah. Or, I mean, I don't want to victim blame, but Sydney, come on, man.
Yeah.
Like when a school bus pulls up, that's when you're like, oh, this isn't a resort. This is some shitting outside nonsense, and I am staying his home.
Yeah.
When I'm right, I'm right. Next time on Again With This, Jane and Jake plot a jailbreak. Kimberly is dubious about Michael's bedside Amanda. Sorry. Sorry. And when Detective Rawlings takes Joe on a tour, nobody gets quite the ride-along they had in mind. Your stomach lining may need a visit from a Dr. Feelgood after you visit our visual aids, which you can find for every episode of Again With This on our website, againwiththispodcast.com. That is also where you will find a link to our very special 90210 book available in all formats. To learn more, follow us on Twitter at AWT90210. For extra episodes, skip the tea service and head straight to patreon.com/againwiththis. Tons of bonus content, and you don't have to listen to it in bed with us if you don't want to, so join today. I'm Outhouse Org Lieutenant Sarah D. Bunting, and I'm on Twitter at Tomato Nation. My co-host is wig zinger Tara Ariano, and she's on Twitter at Tara Ariano. And for the last time, stop parking David T. Cole by the pool. It gets grease everywhere. Talk to you next time.